Okay. All right. So this is Elisa Permain, and I'm on the Healing Story Alliance board and in charge of getting people to sign up for conferences. So if anyone is interested on the call, we'd love to hear your perspectives. And you can talk to me about that later. But right now, I'm very excited that we have Lee Ellen Marvin. She is, she was my first ever storytelling teacher back at Lesley College. I think it was about 1982. And Lee Ellen really got the whole storytelling revival, you know, helped it along greatly in the Boston area, and did that for many years, went out to California and continued to teach, and went to Pennsylvania, got her PhD in folklore, and then somehow ended up in Ithaca, and now is the executive director of the Suicide Prevention and Crisis, what do you call it, team organization in Ithaca, and has been using storytelling and her many other skills in interesting ways. And I know personally, as a therapist who has suicidal clients, I'm really interested, but I think it's good for everyone to know. Okay, Lee Ellen, I'll mute myself, and you take over. Okay?
Okay, Elisa. All right, thank you. So this is Lee Ellen, and yeah, I'm grinning because I do remember Elisa in that it was probably my second storytelling class to teach. And we've both had interesting journeys. And I'm still actually very surprised that I work for Suicide Prevention and Crisis Service here in the Southern Tier, so the Finger Lakes region of New York State. And so my job as the, I have two jobs, and one is executive director and the other one is the director of education. And I really came in using my storytelling skills running something called the Community Role Players, and that led me to taking on education, and that's a kind of a natural progression since education is communication
Claire.
And storytellers. Hi, Claire. It's Lee Ellen. I've just gotten started, so you've hardly missed a thing.
Good to hear from you, Lee Ellen.
My work as educator for suicide prevention is to help people understand suicide, suicide thoughts, and how we can prevent suicide. And really, suicide prevention is primarily a one-on-one activity in many ways. It's giving people who are struggling with suicide thoughts a chance to talk about their reasons for wanting to die. And through that conversation, a supportive listener, and it doesn't have to be a professional, but you know, professional counselors are extremely good at listening without judgment, without trying to fix, but listening for the reasons for living that are expressed within the reasons for dying. And what we really need to do is help people get out of their isolation and enhance their help-seeking behaviors. We know that people who are struggling with suicide thoughts are usually struggling with a lot of issues, and 90% of them, 90% of the people who die by suicide have a diagnosable mental health challenge, and only 30% of those had been receiving any care at the time that they died. So how do we get people who are struggling with thoughts of suicide to come out of isolation? And part of their downward spiral is to withdraw more and more from their community, their friends, their family. How do we get them to reach out? How do we get them at least to put up a signal enough that somebody can say, hey, you're in trouble. What's going on? How do we get them to understand that the self-care that they might learn to give to themselves, learning how to relax, learning how to do something fun, is actually important and valuable? And help-seeking behaviors all around are challenging in a nation that has a culture that really validates rugged individualism, self-sufficiency. And what we're finding is that in terms of our mental health of our nation, this is not a healthy culture. And suicide, unfortunately, has been increasing in the last, since 2011, we've been seeing an increase in suicide deaths. And for me, the big shocker was a couple of years ago when I realized that more people were dying by suicide than by automobile accident deaths. We're in serious trouble right now as a nation. So my job is to somehow make a very difficult, challenging, triggering topic and educational goal into something that people can actually get their heads around without, you know, kind of withdrawing. And it's not easy. So one of the things I do is tell stories when I get a chance. Of course, after all these years of storytelling, it's great to find some reason to slip a story into the work that I do. And often I might tell this simple little story. It is from southern Florida. It was collected by Zora and Neil Hurston. And some of you may recognize that it has roots that connect us back to West Africa. And the story is called The Talking Mule. There once was a farmer, and he had 40 acres. He had a family. He had a barn, and he had a mule. And every day, the farmer and the mule... There's someone who can mute by pressing star 6. That if you haven't done that, please press star 6 to mute. This farmer every day would go out into the fields and work under the hot Florida sun with his mule. They would plow, they would weed, and they would reap the harvest. But on Sunday, the mule got to stand in the cool shade of the barn and have a day of rest when the rest of the family went to church. One day it happened that the family was going to visit the wife's family for church, and they were going to have to go about 2 miles away. The farmer got to thinking that his little children were too small to walk that distance. So he asked his oldest boy to hitch up a wagon to the mule so that the children might be able to ride on the way to the work, onto church. The boy did as he told. He went into the barn. He pulled the mule out of the stable. And he pulled up the wagon and took those long wooden tracers that stretch out from the wagon, back the mule into them. And then he got all the leather rigging and the tack. And he was just about to put this tack over the mule's back when the mule picked up his head. He looked at the boy straight in the eye. And just as plain as I'm talking to you today, the mule spoke. And the mule said, "Hey, isn't it Sunday? Don't I get a day of rest?" The boy was so surprised, he dropped the rigging, he ran out of the barn, he ran to his father, and he said, "Pappy, Pappy, the mule, he don't want to go to church today." The father, like many fathers, rolled his eyes and said, "Do I have to do everything?" And he scolded the boy, but the boy said, "No, sir, really, the mule, he talked." "Now, I don't like it," said the farmer, "when you lie just to get out of something you don't want to do." And he walked to the barn. Now, there was the donkey standing in the middle of the barn. There was the wagon. There was all the tack lying on the ground of the floor of the barn. And the mule was standing there patiently. So the farmer picked up the tack and started to put it over the mule's back. And just then, the mule lifted up his head. He looked the farmer straight in the eye, and he said, "It's Sunday. You and me, we both deserve a day of rest." Once again, the farmer, he dropped the tack. He ran out of the barn. His faithful hound dog came running along with him. He turned around and he looked into the dark opening of the barn, and he said, "I never heard a mule talk before." The dog right next to him said, "Me neither." Now the farmer really freaked out. He ran out of the barnyard and he ran into the house. He ran into the house where his wife was getting all the little kids dressed and ready to go to the church. He said, I don't know. I mean, they're little kids. They're too small to walk that distance. But, you know, I don't know. The mule, he talked to me. And the wife said, "What is all this foolishness you're saying? Mules don't talk." "No, he talked. And the dog, he talked too." And the farmer and his wife went back and forth about whether animals could talk at all. When right next to the wife, where the cat was sitting, and the cat was taking a long tongue bath, and the cat looked up and said, "What's so unusual about a talking mule?" And that's the story of the talking mule. And I often precede this by saying, this is a story with roots in West Africa. And in West Africa, people don't like stories that are tied up with a little bow. They prefer a story that leaves a little raft over to be talked about. So one of the things I do is I turn to people and I say, which character can you identify with in this story? And if I take this story to our local hospital, to the behavioral services unit, what we'll see is that a lot of people will say, I identify with the mule. And they'll explain they're in the hospital in part because they're just exhausted, either struggling with their trauma, their depression or anxiety, or they're overworked and they're just exhausted. There's physically wrong with them, but they just can't, you know, they can't really focus anymore. And so they say, you know, I identify with the talking mule. He just wants his day of rest. He wants release and relief. And that gives me a chance to say, when people are struggling with suicide thoughts, the challenge is where to find someone to talk to. Because if you're thinking about suicide and you try to share that with people, many people will throw their hands up and go running away. It's a scary idea. So where do you find someone to talk to? And then from there, I can punch in. You can call the crisis line. That's our hotline. 24 hours a day, you can call 1-800-273-TALK, and we're there to listen to you. We won't try to fix you. We won't try to judge you. We're just going to try to help you figure out what you want to do, how you want to start to feel better. So this always gets people's attention. When I tell stories at the hospital, especially the younger people, people in their 20s just seem to sink into the stories. It's an extremely intimate setting. I'm sitting at a smallish table, a conference table, not too huge, and everyone's right around me. Usually there's somebody on each side of me. So it really is kind of almost like a family setting in terms of a dinner table kind of a feeling. And I have had to learn how to, you know, really turn off my stage voice and tell my stories in a more simple and direct way. And all of that leads to conversations about how we can get help for mental health. So one of the things that really intrigues me is how people do listen and how it creates an opportunity to talk about difficult issues. And some recent research has been coming out using functional MRI imaging. So what this does is it people have to be kind of strapped into a machine, but as best they can, they have to be very still, but the functional MRI machine records which parts of their brains are active while they're doing an activity. And the most important study that really, I think, those many of us as storytellers are going to go, I thought so all along, is a study, the article is called Speaker-Listener Neural Coupling Underlying Successful Communication. And what was discovered was that if a storyteller has a functional MRI recording of the brain while they tell a story, they will see that all the sensory details of the story activate the part of the brain associated with receiving or sensing emotion. So the emotional part of the brain is active, the part of the brain that processes tactile information or movement is active, visual parts of the brain are activated, smell and sound are activated by the senses in the story. And when listeners were then put into a functional MRI machine and given the same story to listen to, what the MRI recording showed us is that the same parts of the brain are activated in the listener as were activated in the storyteller. There's one main difference, which is that the parts of the brain that are responsible for predictive thinking is actually working a little bit harder in the listener and is often, you know, that part's really connected much more deeply than it even is for the storyteller. So what this says to us is that when you're listening to a story, you really are having a very, you're having an experience. It's not just, yes, you're working hard to process the words, but you're also, because those parts of your brain that are involved with processing sensory information are activated, the result is that the story in its recollection is not really different from a recalled experience. So the experiences that we remember, we almost always shape into story, and that helps us both remember the experience and create meaning out of the experience. And for the story listener, their experience of hearing your story is very close to as if they had had the experience. They then, if they remember the story, they're reshaping the story in their own way, using the imagery that was triggered by in their own brains. And then they are, if they retell the story, they're creating a new meaning and a new sense of connection to that story. So what I take from this is that it's a really important way to get people to start rehearsing different ways of being in the world. So if we go back to the talking mule, and often I tell that story and someone will look up and say, what's that got to do with suicide? And I, you know, again, I say, well, if you got something difficult to talk about and no one's willing to talk about it, what are you going to do? But the mule models directness. The mule says, hey, I thought I got a day off. What's going on? And so one of the things we can talk about is it's good that he asked that question, and he just wants an answer. Other stories that I tell in my program, there's a Russian fairy tale called Misery, and it's a beautiful example of how depression can lead to addictions, to a downward spiral, and, you know, you can have a lot of life struggles as you try to deal with the depression. And in this story, Misery is depicted as a creature. I always visualize Misery as something like Gollum in Lord of the Rings. But Misery jumps onto a poor man's back, wraps its legs around his waist, digs its claws into the farmer's shoulder, and says, hey, I'm really thirsty. Let's go to the bar. And because Misery is such a mess, nobody wants this thing in the house, so the farmer goes back to the bar every day until all of his money is gone. And he then goes to his brother and asks for help. And his brother helps the farmer get rid of Misery. And then at the end, my one change to this classic Russian fairy tale is to have the brother say, don't you remember when things went really bad for me a few years ago and Misery was on my back? And the main character says, well, yeah, I remember, and we helped as much as we could. I sent food to you and your family. And the brother says, well, how did it make you feel to help me? Oh, of course, it made me feel good to help you. Then why not give me the joy of helping you? So the story takes the listeners down the path of falling down into a pit of despair, depression, addiction, and then reaching out to get help and having someone say, this is really what I want to do. I do want to help you. And I could say that at the hospital, occasionally there are patients who say, oh, I wouldn't bother you people with calling at the crisis line. You probably have more important people to talk to or people with bigger need. And I have to say, you're here because you're really struggling with a mental health concern. You may have been here because you attempted suicide. That's very important, and we want to talk to you. I also tell the story of King Solomon's ring, the ring that has on it the words, this too shall pass. And I really draw out the secret words that are on the ring. I wait until the last possible moment to share what's on the ring. And I draw out King Solomon's experience as a guy who's really anxious. Everybody thinks he's super cool because he does all these wise things. But in fact, he can hardly sleep at night because he keeps thinking, I'm going to blow it. I'm going to make a mistake. Or somebody else is going to come and invade my country and my people will be, you know, sent into poverty and depression, and how am I going to hold it all together? So he dreams about a ring being handed to him, I can't remember the words in the dream. And I have other characters who become very anxious. We've got to find this ring for King Solomon. And when they finally find the ring, we still hold off on the last minute is the last thing. Finally, what did the ring say? It said, this too shall pass. And I close the story there, but I say, listen, if you had a gold ring with a few words that had the power to calm you down, what would that ring say? And if I'm lucky, there's a staff member sitting in, there's one particular woman who say, well, I always say let go and let God. And so I accept that, and I say, you know, for me, what works is name the feeling. I've learned that if I can name what I'm feeling, I almost immediately feel better. So that's what my ring would say. And we go around the room. What would your ring say? So it's a chance for everyone in the room to think about, yeah, if there was just a phrase, then what I see there is that the people who have been in the hospital for a little while, they often, through their group experiences and their counseling, they started to kind of, they've gotten stabilized and they've gotten ideas about, you know, kind of the things that help them that they've learned about while they've been at the hospital. And so, you know, hopefully people will have a few things to say that work for them as their little magic ring, that touchstone. And I also tell the story, the British story, Midwife to the Fairies, which is a story, I turned it into a story about grief. I've really elaborated it a lot in my own way. But a lot of it is about that way of where do we find the resources in our life, the practices, the self-care, the moments of joy. How do we reach back in spite of deep grief to find the things that give us hope? And in between my program, as we're talking about the stories, sometimes people tell stories about their own experiences and why they landed in the hospital. But I keep saying, the crisis line is here for you. The crisis line is here, ready to listen. You can call us at any time. If you're having trouble getting out of bed, call us. If you're having trouble calming down at night, call us. So that's what I do. That's the work I do. And it's been really exciting to keep an eye on the neurology studies that are coming out that confirm so much of what we already know as storytellers instinctively. You know, learning that my constant goal to have a deep internal sensory path that walks me through the story without memorization. In fact, that's really important to creating the neural coupling that the fMRI studies have pointed to. And there are I'm not one of the storytellers, but there are storytellers who have noticed times when their audience, all their audience members are breathing together, they're sighing together, they're nodding together. So more experienced performing storytellers have noticed they've been able to observe the coupling that the studies have been pointing to. And, you know, that piece of the highly predictive, the predicted part of our brain, that part, that the prefrontal cortex that's thinking about what to do next, that's engaged in story listening, I think is really important because we want people to get comfortable at climbing out of difficult experiences and saying, well, what can I do next? What's my next best step? How can I calm down? And so we need to provide people with those opportunities to step out a little bit. So I think I've spoken for enough time. I'd love to hear some of your questions or comments or your own experiences that sit with us.
Hey, Leon?
Yep.
No?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is Philip. To respond to your question from the first story, the character that I identify is the cat, because the cat shows empathy. And I think that's kind of the theme of all those stories, really, isn't it? That we need to have empathy and that people are listening to you. That's the sense I get.
Yeah, yeah. That's so true, and the work that we do on the crisis line, you know, really all we do is listen to people's stories, and then we reflect the story in a very short, you know, so what's happening is, and literally when we're teaching our new volunteers, we say, this is your sentence. So what's happening is, and you're feeling. So what's happening is you failed classes in your freshman year. You're really terrified about telling your parents what's been going on for you. And what we're doing at that point is just like the cat saying, hey, what's the big deal here? Yes, you are struggling and you have feelings about it. And we as a listener have linked in with you so that we understand what's happened. Another question?
Well, Lisa, it's very a lot of reverb going on. I don't know why.
Lee Ellen, this is Carolyn Little, and I missed the first part of your presentation. How did you get the hospital engaged with you in this storytelling effort?
The behavioral services unit at the hospital likes to have community organizations come in for their Friday afternoon groups. NAMI, the National Association for Mental, National Association for Mental Health.
For the mentally ill, yeah.
For the mentally ill. They come once a month to do a program. The local mental health association comes. And actually, NAMI is there almost weekly to work with family members or people who are in the hospital. So they had just created that. They didn't know about the storytelling. And I said, will it be okay? Because it doesn't take long to tell people about the crisis line, but it takes a while to get people to consider the crisis line. And so part of what I wanted to do was, and I'm always looking for an excuse to tell stories. So I just said, well, here's how I'm going to do it. Let me know if it works for you. And the staff, you know, has constantly supported me. I ask that there be a staff member in the room with me most of the time. And they really enjoy it. And they also have an adolescent unit, and I started going over there too. And sometimes with the adolescents, we'll, you know, depending on what the connection is like with the kids, sometimes I pull out paper and we do drawings of the story. Sometimes they have stories to share with me, and we get to talk about those too. But it was just a very lucky thing. They really wanted another community organization represented as part of their programming. And I just said, okay, well, here's what you get.
Thank you. Thank you. Can I ask another question?
I think we should all mute unless we're talking because it seems like it's going on, okay?
Lee Ellen, have you done anything with the associations of survivors of suicide? Tends to have an active support group here in the Capital District.
We have a long history. Our organization is 47 years old. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
So our organization has for a long time had a support group for survivors of suicide loss. So those are the people who have lost a loved one to suicide. And we've done a lot of different kinds of programming around that. And one of the things that I had the deep honor of doing was helping to create a series of altered chairs. It was an art project for people who had lost someone to suicide. And they were we found an artist who had really brilliant processing for helping people visualize what their grief and loss was like. And then they created these altered chairs. And if you go to our website, IthacaCrisis.org, ithacacrisis.org, You can, if you browse around in the website, you'll find your way to the empty chairs, and you can look and see what some of that work was like.
Okay.
Recently, we've had a difficult time finding enough people to sit together as in a group for support, and we're not quite sure what the issue is. Our county is pretty small. We only have 100,000 people, so in a big city it would be much bigger. We have, from time to time, we've jumped in with the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. They have an annual day for grieving, and we've sometimes offered programs. But there's a chapter in our area right now, so they're taking over that programming. And we've been wanting to do something like a traditional Day of the Dead altar, and we keep trying to find enough staff energy to make it happen. But a time for people to come and bring objects that relate to their loved one who's lost, and we thought that would be not just for suicide loss, but anything. And we have an after trauma program, so we see a lot of people individually supporting them through a suicide loss or any trauma. And if there's been a trauma or a loss in a community that's very tight-knit, like a school or a business, we've done a lot of support for those communities. So we'll go into the schools, talk to the principal to talk about what their next steps are in those first immediate days after a suicide death, and how, you know, give them models for what they were going to write to the parents to talk about this loss. How can they organize an appropriate memorial program? How can they protect the school against other suicides that are inspired by the initial one? So it's a big part of our work, and it's sad to me that we, for some reason, haven't been able to pull together a support group to happen on a regular basis. But we do support people in any way we can.
Thank you.
Thank you. Leah, it's Elisa. I have a lot of questions. I love the focus of your work on thing and all the stories were exciting. One thing that seems to come up a lot, people feeling that their families would be better off without them. And I wonder how you might address that. I mean, there's logic, but logic doesn't, you know, really seem to be working in terms of that. And so, you know, whether it's some education of actually how it affects family members and children,
That's a serious struggle. When we're counseling people on the crisis line, if someone says that, we tend to say, I know you feel that way right now, but we know from great experience talking to people who have lost a family member that they're not better off. So, you know, we'll just say, in our experience, we haven't found anyone who is better off because of a suicide loss. And that's not completely true, because I have heard one person in all the years that I've been listening to people talk about suicide losses. This was still just third, fourth hand. Somebody was very violent, and the family was terrified of being harmed by this particular person. So when the family member died by suicide, there was a little bit of relief because they were out of danger, their own personal danger. But I still can imagine that the recovery was really difficult. I do think it might be interesting to find a story that works on that. I've never actually developed a performance story about the experience of losing someone by suicide. And that might be interesting. We really, on the crisis line, we don't want to spend a lot of time guilt-tripping people. We want them to find their own reasons for staying alive. So we say, your family, our experience is your family wouldn't be better off. But what we're hearing is you care about your family. And you feel you've disappointed them a lot, and that's part of why you're feeling so bad.
Right.
And see if we can get that movement towards, here's something you really value. Even if you value it so much you're thinking about death, but rather we want you, you know, it is something that about life that's really important to you.
Right. Yep. Yeah. That's forward.
Alisa, just what I've been seeing in the literature for suicide is there's a training called CAM, and I'm forgetting exactly what CAM stands for. But that's for therapists who are working with suicidal clients.
How is that spelled? CAM?
CAMS.
CAMS, like a cans of soup?
Like a camera with the hurrah taken off. CAMS.
CAMS, okay.
And I'll try to look up a resource for you on that.
Okay. Great. Yeah.
Oh, Leon.
Go ahead.
Oh, this is Jeremy in Los Angeles.
Hi, Jeremy.
Hi. Thank you for your presentation and the story. I was wondering if you've compiled the list of folk tales and whatnot that address this issue. If you have over the years compiled the list.
You know, my repertory is woefully tiny, and really, Alisa Perrin's book on wisdom tales is a really fine collection. It's pathetic. I just have four stories, and I tell them over and over again. And because
they're probably very effective, too.
Pardon?
I said they're probably very effective, though.
They're effective. I love them. I mean, I have that deep sense of, oh, I get to be with these characters again every time I start the stories. I love how much they change with every audience, especially because telling in the hospital is so intimate. So that you know, people whoever's sitting at the table has a big impact on how that story comes out. The Talking Mule is from Zora Neale Hurston's collection.
Whose collection?
Zora Neale Hurston.
Okay.
And the Russian fairy tale of misery, you can find that in the Pantheon collection of Russian fairy tales.
Okay.
King Solomon's Ring, you know, I just have kind of known it always, so I didn't actually look for sources. I just kind of scraped it out of my brain and made it into my own.
Yeah. That's okay. That's how storytellers do it all the time.
and then Midwest of the Fairies, likewise, Catherine Briggs, her collection of British folk tales. I think it's in there. And that one has really become very, I modernized that a lot. An old woman is greeted at her door by a fairy, and she's walked through the village in the traditional story, and in my version, escorted into a big old 1950s car that travels like a boat. And as she kind of drifts off to sleep as it drives through the night, and the city lights kind of enchant her. And then when she wakes up, she's surrounded by these enormous trees. So in my vision, she actually becomes very tiny, and she can enter this tree house that's built right into the trunk of a tree. And that's really it. And I also wrote an original story called Ringing the Bell that is meant to be performed for middle and high school students. And I purposely made it quite melodramatic. It's set in a high school, and the high school has some Gothic architecture, so it
kind of feels like a Harry Potter kind of high school or high school like Hollywood movies. And there's a girl who's really popular. There's a girl who's not popular. There's boys who are, there are girls who are kind of mean. And there's this whole device about having to go up into a bell tower and ringing the bell to signal the start of the day every day. And one girl is about to kill herself by jumping from the tower, and another girl is trying to hold on to her and keep her from dying. And the only way she can get the help that she needs is by ringing a bell. And at out of time, that at a time when the bell is not normally rung. And what I'm trying to say to middle school is, if your friend is talking about suicide, you must immediately get help from an adult. Do not mess with this. You don't have to tell anyone why your friend is thinking about suicide, but you do need to tell an adult that this is going on. That's a big struggle for teens. They call us and they say, my friend is thinking about suicide, and we say, why don't you talk to the parents and tell the parents that this is what's happening with their child? Oh, they'd be so mad at me. We have to say, here's your choice. Your friend might die, or they might be mad at you. Which would you rather?
Yeah.
Someday I would like to, like, go crawling through my collection of folktales and find a few more stories. But, you know, the biggest mental health challenges that people deal with are anxiety and depression. And from the reading I've been doing, it looks like an untreated anxiety can lead you to depression. And then adjustment disorder. So if somebody is grieving, they're dealing with a huge change in their life. And so that's in part why Midwife to the Fairies is one of the stories I tell.
Well, thank you.
Well, you're welcome.
So what was the name of that last story, the midwife story?
Midwife to the Fairies.
To the fairy?
To the fairies, yeah, or fairy.
Midwife to the Fairies, I got it.
Yeah, super simple story. A midwife, someone comes knocking on the door of a midwife in the middle of the night, and it's a kind of a strange-looking man. Who says, my wife needs your help. She's trying to birth a baby, and, you know, we really need your help. And he takes her to an odd part of town that she's never seen before. And it turns out she's helping a fairy woman give birth. And she helps the fairy give birth like she's supposed to. And then she goes home. And in some versions of the story, she has some special treasure that she's left with. That's the simplest form. I elaborated it a little bit. And what I did is I wrapped around that a story of grief. The midwife is grieving, and she's still missing her husband after 3 or 4 years. And when the fairies ask her to come and help, she says, but I'm not a midwife, I'm a nurse. Yeah, I worked in obstetrics, but you seem to be confusing me with my grandmother, who was a midwife and got me interested in nursing. And then they say, no, we want you to come on, help, help, help. And when she gets to the fairy home, she remembers an herb that her grandmother had mentioned to her, and she uses that herb. And this is, for me, the metaphor here is reach back. You have in yourself ways of helping yourself heal, and you need to trust those old things that came to you over the years. If it's taking a walk through the woods, or if it's drinking a cup of tea, or if it's drawing or writing in your journal, find those things that always have helped you through tough times and use them again.
That's so beautiful.
Excellent. Thank you.
The idea of teaching people how to listen seems so basic to this. It's cool. We don't know how to listen anymore. So the role of the storyteller is about teaching people to listen to, how to hear the story, how to help people.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that helps me is that people who are in the hospital, they're not allowed to have their cell phones. So there's that whole level of distraction that has been stripped away. The other thing that happens is that depends on the composition of who's in the unit at the time, but they often have created a really wonderful little community. One day I was telling stories, and a very young woman took a deep, suddenly kind of gasped and said, "Oh no, oh no." And everyone around her immediately turned. A couple of people put their hands on her. Somebody got water and said, "It's okay. Just keep breathing. Just keep breathing." And she quickly calmed down. And seeing how they pulled together to help her at that moment, I said, there's something remarkable that happens in the hospital. And one of the things I need to do is on the opposite end, is to help people understand that it's not a disaster if you have to go to the hospital for a mental health care.
Right.
It will be an opportunity to catch your breath, get off the treadmill. And literally one time I told the story, I said, "Okay, who do you identify with?" And two different men said, they identified with the talking mule. And they both came from very different work. One of them worked as a groundskeeper for a man who had a lot of different properties all over town. He did the mowing and the shoveling. And tech medical profession. He wasn't a doctor, but he supported doctors, and he was on call all the time. Neither of them had had a day off for like 6 months or more. And both of them literally collapsed. So when they heard the story of the talking mule, they just, you know, it was like their stories poured out of them. "I've never got a day off. I tried to tell my boss I needed a day off, that I couldn't do this anymore." And one of them talked about all the family events that had been missed because he never had a Saturday or Sunday off. So it was really, you know, it was striking. And that's when I realized I'd heard the psychiatrist at the unit talking about how many of the people who come to the hospital are the working wounded, not the walking wounded, but the working wounded. There are people that are doing their best to get through their day, and you wouldn't imagine that they're struggling with a mental health challenge. And there comes a point in some people's lives where it's like, not one more step. But.
Well,
I have a question for you guys. Would you be interested in following through on some of the articles that I've read on fMRI imaging and storytelling?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Is there a way that I can send to you, Elisa, a short little bibliography that you could distribute?
Yeah, I can put it up on the Healing Story Alliance.
Okay.
Listserv, and if anybody's not on that, then they should perhaps give me, you or I, their email.
Okay.
Anybody who can't reach the HSA listserv on the call? Probably not. Great. Okay.
So here's, speaking of those studies, one area that I would like to start doing some reading on next, connecting storytelling, story listening, and mental health, is to look at secondary traumatic stress, which is, this is a kind of PTSD that can happen to people who work closely with, you know, supporting clients who've had trauma, very difficult life experiences. So what we're learning is that if you listen to a lot of really difficult life stories, it can create, if you're in the role of the caregiver, you may in fact experience some traumatic stress. And it's the title is Secondary Traumatic Stress. But I'm stricken by this because basically the caregiver is the one who listens to the story. And so it makes sense with what I know about story listening and what the fMRI studies are telling us about story listening, that in fact, if you're listening to the stories, you're having the experience in some way. And so for the caregivers, they need some really powerful ways of saying, yes, I heard that story deeply, and I'm okay.
I'm okay.
Right.
Yes, I'm very interested in that. That sounds absolutely right on.
Right on.
I think that's...
I know
what it's
What
did you say?
Is this Allison?
Allison? This is Cora. I came late to the event.
Hi, Cora.
But the secondary mental health problem, I can personally relate to that myself. So I think that would be something I'd be interested in connecting with you about that.
Yeah, and I don't have anything smart to say about it, but I think we do need to recognize if you're a caregiver that the listening experience is powerful. And so I think this is a new area to think about. How do we hear the story deeply but not make it our own?
Well, I think not only the caregiver, as a caregiver, but in a different sense that I think you're talking about, is parents of people who have, because that's where I'm coming from. I have a daughter who had some anxiety and depression issues, and she's 28, and it's taken me just about 28 years to be able to not have her tapes mess with me. You know, I can now know that this is her and this is who she is and this is what she's going on, and it doesn't affect me as much as it did growing up, when she was growing up. It was really difficult. It's difficult being a parent of a child that has a mental health issue.
Right.
And are you in touch with your local chapter of NAMI?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, yeah. All right. It is not easy at all, and I'm, you know.
Well, one of the main problems is I live in a small town, and just trying to get the professionals to help her was a task of years of finding the right professional to be able to give her the support that she needed.
Yeah,
and it's all worked out. It's all fine. It's all beautiful. But the path was at times very difficult.
Yeah.
So
and do
looking
you,
at the
do
caregiver,
you also,
go ahead.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I was just saying the caregiver as the parent, who is also a caregiver. But not in the professional sense of the word.
Right. No, and the love that you feel for a child is such a struggle to watch a child. I mean, just taking care of a healthy child is a struggle in many ways. And to have to, you know, kind of pull together the resources that someone with really special needs, this is not easy at all. I'm remembering I heard long ago an Italian fairy tale about a child who was born very sickly, and the only thing I remember about it was that a kind of a midwife or witch healer came to the castle and said, "I can heal your princess," but she had to take her away to the high mountain and expose her to the light of dawn. And every morning she would hold this child out into the light of the first lights of dawn. And that's how the child healed. And then it went on to another very complicated fairy tale thing. And I think the healer turned out to be a rather envious and restrictive witch who kept the princess from going on to live her own life. And, you know, it's the best thing that comes to my mind right now.
Well, I love that because the light of the light of the dawn can be interpreted so many ways.
Mm-hmm.
Because what my daughter needed to do was to be able to see the light that she had power, almost like you talked about earlier, power within, that she had to find her own confidence, and she had to find her own ability, to her own strength. And that's with her light of dawn, you know, as she walks the path of healing.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So the light of dawn can be a lot of different things.
Yeah.
Well, I think even, you know, parent or not, caregiver, we often feel like we want to be able to do more than we can do, you know, to undo someone's pain. And that's part of it. Just recognizing, you know, I can help, but I can't solve. And also,
I can't fix your pain. I can't fix your pain. I can only walk the path with you.
But also the issue of, yes, we can literally take on the images of the traumatic that someone told us. And I think Ellen was saying it's so good to have, you know, the caregiver has to have their own images of strength, places to go in their imagination that are very calming and safe, and, you know, ways to literally the imagination away from those traumatic pictures and feelings. There's a lot of tricks to the trade, I'll tell you, but I know some of the therapists I work with, we literally do some acupressure after difficult situations to sort of help put memories. Because it's dramatic work.
Yeah.
Well, as a parent, you're on call all the time. And as a parent, you're not like my office hours are 8 to 5. Call me back during my office hours.
It's 9:59. Does anyone have one last comment?
Just to say thank you.
Yeah, I thank you so much. Ellen, this will be taped. It has been recorded. I'm afraid there was a reverb, but within a few weeks it should be up on the site, and hopefully people can go through it at their own leisure if they want to hear parts again. We do have another. Austin, are you there?
Here.
I don't have it in front of me. I thought I did. The next teleconference call is early December. Do you have the date? Is it the 12th? Let me quickly get this up. We are having an interesting talk on dealing with people with Alzheimer's. Let me see here. I'm sorry, I had it up and then it disappeared.
December 8th.
Okay.
Linda Ford. On using stories for professionals, family members, and persons living with Alzheimer's.
Yeah. So we really look forward to that as well, and invite you all to join that. And check out our website. We'll be having Michael McCarty January, speaking about his work in prisons. So lots of good stuff. And again, thank you, Lee Ellen, so much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. It was great to travel down this line of thinking.
Yes, it always is, isn't it? Enriched, and hope to be seeing you soon.
And likewise, I'm looking forward to sharing the fire.
Yeah.
In the spirit of shameless self-promotion, I've developed a storytelling game called Story Shifters, and you can learn about it at storyshiftersgame.com.
a great stocking stuffer.
Oh, excellent. That's great. Okay, well, thank you. Thanks, everybody, and good night. Sleep tight.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Good night.
Are you still there, Elisa?
I am. I'm trying to figure out how to stop the recording.
Maybe we just end the call.